Welcome back. It's great to be hanging out with you all again. This is Joe Davidson. We're hanging out today here at Centertainment Talk Radio here on the web at www.centertainment.org. Well, the holiday season is coming up, and I want to tell you about a really great gift. A few great gifts, actually. And today we're also featuring the author of two of my all-time favorite books. Don't miss this show. So do you ever wake up in the morning and you got that loud, obnoxious alarm sound? Well, I have the perfect solution for you. There's a company called Now Zen. Their website is www.now-zen.com, and they make these beautiful clocks that you can set. They have Tibetan bowls on them, and when the alarm goes off, instead of hearing an obnoxious alarm sound, you hear this beautiful sound of this Tibetan bowl. You can also hook these up to your doorbells or to your telephone ringers. So you can use them for all sorts of things, or maybe for meditation, because you can set it to go off at different times. Check them out, www.now-zen.com. And if you'd like to order them for yourself or your friends and family, you can also call them directly at 1-800-779-6383. And again, that's 1-800-779-6383. I'm really excited to be bringing you this show today. It features the author of two of my all-time favorite books. Her name is Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, and she wrote these beautiful books called My Grandfather's Blessings and Kitchen Table Wisdom. Rachel Remen is also a wonderful doctor, and she was recently honored at an event along with Larry Dossey, Andrew Weil, John Kabat-Zinn, James Gordon, and Dean Ornish. Okay, check this out. You know, it was so interesting to me that your grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi, and then it sounded like your parents really didn't want to talk about God. Was that true?
They were socialists. Mm-hmm. I was what's called a red diaper baby. Mm-hmm. They basically felt that there was nothing, you know, larger than the and, you know, the common good, mm-hmm. and basically, you know, the social welfare and all of this. Mm-hmm. They felt that religion was the opiate of the masses. Mm-hmm. You know, it was only for superstitious people. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all of my mother's brothers were all professors of medicine. You know, mm-hmm. very, very prominent people, heads of departments in various medical schools, very intellectual people. Mm-hmm. And then there was the father of all these people, who was a flaming mystic, Kabbalist.
Do you think did they get turned off because it was too extreme, you think? Or?
Oh, I remember, you know, they would talk about, you know, Grandpa studying his books, which mm-hmm. were the Kabbalah, as if he was, you know, involved in, you know, black magic.
Some occult.
And I, of course, I was a mystical little girl. I was my grandfather's granddaughter, and I was born into this family of, you know, basically agnostics and intellects. Mm-hmm. And without my grandfather there to nurture my sense of mystery and wonder and validate this other way of seeing life, I don't know what would have become of me.
You know, in your book, there was a story I really wanted to share with listeners. You said one night, this was when you were still an intern, and it was around 10 p.m., and a father came rushing in, and he had this unconscious infant in his arms. How scary. And I wondered if you could share what happened that night, because I thought it was a very big moment in your early career there.
Is this the story of the childhood of the cardiac arrest?
Yes.
Yeah, this is very difficult to tell this as a story. Do you want another story about that same thing? I can give you a better one.
Okay, sure.
This is a story that was told to me by a professor of nursing. And it happened when she was a brand new nurse, her first day on the ward. And her mentor met her, and they went on to the wards, walked into the room of this man just as he died. He had a cardiac arrest, a heart attack, right there as they walked into the room. And the mentor called the code. And within minutes, as this woman said, within minutes, the room was filled with people. and they were people acting very decisively. They were calling out numbers. They were wheeling in equipment. You know, they're basically doing a full-bore resuscitation. And she said, you know, in moments, she couldn't even see the patient. There were so many people around, you know, putting needles in his legs and in his arms. You know, but she could see the EKG, and the line was flat. Mm-hmm. His heart had stopped. And so she just backed off into a corner and was completely overwhelmed. And as she watched these people and how decisive they were, she suddenly realized she couldn't do what they were doing. She would never be able to do this kind of thing. And that she had chosen the wrong profession.
Oh, my gosh.
And so she's standing there feeling totally helpless and totally useless. And the code was successful. And as she's standing there, she feels, you know, this man is dying right in front of her. There's nothing she can do. Mm. And yet she feels her own heart is breaking because of this. Mm. And so the code is successful. She goes home and she can't sleep, you know. She's the wrong person. How is she going to tell her parents and her friends, all these people who have sacrificed her, believed in her, that she just can't do this work? So the next morning, having not slept all night, she wants to run away, but she's a very responsible person, so she's expected on the ward. So she goes back. She goes a little early, and she goes into the guy's room just to see if he's okay. He really is okay. And he's sitting up in bed eating Jell-O. The minute he sees her, he says, "There you are. I remember you from yesterday."
Oh, my goodness.
And she says, "I didn't think you saw me." He says, "Oh, yes." He says, "I saw you standing right there in that corner." And then he looked at her and he says, "So many people. They were so busy." He says, "I was right up there," and he points to the ceiling. He says, "I could see them all, but I couldn't get anybody's attention. And I could feel myself," he says, "sort of drifting away and drifting away. And then I saw you standing there in the corner, and I saw how much you wanted it to be okay for me, how much you cared about what was happening to me." He says, "So I just took a hold of you and I held on."
Wow. And here she thought that she wasn't making a difference and she didn't even want to be in this profession. And she was the difference.
Well, the thing that's interesting is that perhaps medicine is not about its science. And perhaps the ways in which we help people and we make a difference are much more mysterious than simply the sum of our expertise and our techniques and our knowledge. This is a woman who, of course, went on to become a full professor of nursing.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires a kind of an expansion mm-hmm. of what you think this work is about. I mean, are we our bodies? Is it all about giving us the right medicine and fixing what's wrong with us? Or is there something beyond that that we do? And is there a way to live as a whole person, even though you may not be a completely well person?
That's a big question. And you know all about that because you've had Crohn's disease. How did that first come about? What happened when you first discovered that you had this? How old were you?
I was 15. And I went to bed one night in my dorm room. I was in college. And I went to bed one night in my dorm room and woke up 6 months later in a hospital room in New York City.
You were in a coma for 6 months?
Mm-hmm. I was in a coma for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And my entire life had changed, of course. And the interesting thing, of course, is that people had gathered around, lots of people in white coats, lots of experts, and they gave us the information. This was a disease that no one knew how to cure. No one even knew what caused it. That I would have multiple surgeries on my intestine in my lifetime, and I could expect to be dead by the time I was 40. This was not my dream in the future. I had something else in mind. So it was a time of utter despair. Mm. Utter despair.
Mm.
And no one, not one of the many doctors around us, and you know, my family's a medical family. There are lots and lots of physicians and nurses in my family. No one questioned this. I mean, this was how it was going to be. No one even suggested to me that there might be something in me that could break through this barrier, that might find a way to live beyond the limitations of this disease. The will to live in people is quite mysterious. You don't find it under W in Harrison's textbooks, textbook of internal medicine. Mm-hmm. You find, you know about the will to live by observing life, by observing the fact that sometimes two little green leaves of grass can grow right through the cement mm-hmm. in New York City. That sometimes sometimes science is too small an explanation for life, and that things happen that science can't explain, but they happen anyway. Mm-hmm. And nobody offered me any kind of hope. And you know, I made a lot of life decisions based on that pronouncement that I would be dead by the time I was 40. I didn't have children. I didn't marry. I didn't want to finish. You know, I didn't want to start something I couldn't finish. And, you know, obviously I've had multiple surgeries on my intestine, and the facts haven't changed. Nobody knows what causes Crohn's. Nobody knows how to cure it. But I haven't been dead these 28 years. There is always the dimension of mystery. Whenever you are dealing with people and not their diseases, whenever you're dealing with whole people, there are dimensions that can't be measured or analyzed, but that manifest themselves anyway, like the will to live.
Did you ever go through periods where you blamed yourself for the illness or felt that you should be able to cure it by some strength of your will or by something?
Actually, no. Mm-hmm. No, I never blamed myself for it. It was always presented to me as something that that was happening because of, you know, a disease process.
I guess that's different than chronic fatigue immune dysfunction, where they don't really know exactly what it is. So there is more of a blame that people put on themselves because they think, well, surely it would show up in standard labs.
Chronic fatigue, see, there's another issue in chronic fatigue, which is that because the disease process is not worked out, people will actually suggest to you that it's all in your mind. That, you know, that I think is more than the guilt. It's almost like you're making it up. You know, you're making a play for people's pity, or for you know, getting out of things that are your responsibility. Mm-hmm. That I think is incredibly cruel. Mm-hmm. I think with Crohn's, there was always something to look at. In other words, when you look at an intestine in Crohn's, you can see the disease process. Mm-hmm. Something is happening, right?
It validates it.
It was not a made-up-in-your-head disease. No one could say that. Mm-hmm. I think it's much more difficult to have chronic fatigue than mm-hmm. Crohn's in many ways because of that.
I love in your book when you said it's not just to learn good medicine, but to be good medicine. And I get that feeling from you in your writing and in what you've become as a doctor, that you are good medicine.
I think a lot of us are good medicine, and many of us are not doctors, but we're good medicine.
Yes.
Because, you know, healing isn't about the work of experts. Healing is about the work of human beings.
What's the difference between helping someone, okay, even as a friend, helping someone versus being of service?
I think there are three different things that people get mixed up. And one is helping people. The other is fixing people. And the last is, you know, being of service. And when you help somebody, you use your own strength, you know, to help them. And it's very difficult not to relate to them as a person of lesser strength. The person's weaker than you are. And you're helping them with your strength. And when you fix people, you're counting on your expertise. You know, there's a judgment implied in fixing people. People are broken. They need to be repaired. People aren't broken. They're just sick. And as a matter of fact, when people become sick, often something becomes very strong in them, which wasn't there before. So in many ways, they may become even stronger people than they were before they got sick. But when you serve someone, you're always serving an equal. Not about sitting in judgment in people or helping the weak or anything like this. It's about being able to see and trust the hidden wholeness in someone, even at a time when they are ill, and recognizing that you can nurture that wholeness in them. It's like the humanity in you speaks to the humanity in them, that nobody is a perfect person. Everybody is wounded. And that because you yourself are a wounded person, you can trust the process of healing, which you have experienced in your own life. And you can trust that other people have access to them as well.
All these things, when you really go through them, they make you so much more compassionate.
Don't you think? I agree. It seems to me that through our suffering, we recognize that everyone is vulnerable to suffering. And we recognize that compassion is one of the outcomes of suffering. Compassion for yourself, compassion for others, a sense of the shared vulnerability of what it means to be a human being, and also the shared strength of what it means to be a human being.
I love the things you said in your book about meaning, and there was one story I would love for you to tell, if you can remember it. It was this Italian psychiatrist. How do you say his name? Roberto
Astagioli.
This parable about three stone cutters, and it's beautiful, about finding meaning in our lives. Do you remember the story?
I surely do. I think it's a beautiful parable. It basically says that meaning strengthens us, not by changing our lives or changing our work, but by changing the way we see our lives and the way we experience our lives and the way we experience our work. It basically asks you to imagine that we're in the Middle Ages and we're watching three stone cutters building a cathedral. And we stand to the side, we're watching these three men work. And the first man, they're all three of them doing the same thing. People bring them a rock. They cut it with great expertise into a block, a foot by 9 inches. And then someone takes the block away and they bring them another rock. And then each one of them will cut the rock into a block, a foot by 9 inches, and then someone takes it away, and they bring them another rock. So they're doing the same thing over and over and over again. And after we stand there for a while, we go to the first fellow, and we say to him, "Excuse me, sir, what are you doing?" And he turns on us, and with a great deal of hostility, says, "You idiots, use your eyes. And I saw you standing there watching me. You can see what I'm doing. They bring me a rock. I turn it into a block. They take it away. They bring me another one. Turn it into a block." He says, "I've been doing this ever since the day I was old enough to work, and I'll be doing it to the day I die. Why are you asking such a stupid question? You can see what I'm doing." And we back away, you know, from this attitude. You know. We go on to the next fellow, and we say, "Excuse me, sir, what are you doing?" And he smiles at us. And he says, "I am earning a living here for my beloved family. With the wages they pay me, I have built a strong house, and there's good food on the table, and our dear children are growing big. I'm earning a living for my beloved family." And then we go on to the third man, the third stonecutter, and we say to him, "And what are you doing?" And his face is absolutely radiant. And he says, "I am building a great cathedral, a holy lighthouse where people who are lost and frightened and alone in the dark can come and be comforted and know that there is no place for them to go to be alone. And this is going to stand for 1,000 years. And, of course, the teaching in the story is that each one of these men are doing exactly the same thing. They're cutting rocks into blocks over and over and over again. Except that doing the most routine and ordinary of tasks If you have a deep sense of the meaning of what you're doing, the most routine and ordinary becomes filled with a sense of joy and even a sense of privilege for the opportunity to do this work.
That is one of the most beautiful stories. I loved that.
Do you have time for another story?
Yeah.
Let me tell you George's story. Sometimes it's the meaning of our work that gives us a sense of peace at the end of life, not how much we've accumulated, how big our houses are, or how fancy our cars are. And George came to see me when he was diagnosed with end-stage colon cancer. There was almost no treatment for him. And I had thought he'd be very depressed by that, you know, but that wasn't what was on his mind. There was something else on his mind. And he sat down in my examining room and he looked at me and he said, "Rachel, I've wasted my life." He says, "I have 3 children and 2 wives. I've supported all of them. I don't know any of them. I don't think they're going to miss me. I don't think anyone is going to miss me. I've spent my whole life doing business. I've created a part of a medical invention that has enabled people whose disease was previously unmanageable to live almost normally. And, you know, I have a factory that creates these parts and distributes them worldwide." He says, "I'm a very wealthy man. And the only thing that I'm leaving behind me is a whole lot of money." And then his eyes filled with tears, and he didn't want me to see, so he looked away. And then I thought I heard him say something like, "What a fool. What a fool I've been." Now, this invention that George made, I had a patient at that time who was using this invention, the part that the invention made possible. Mm-hmm. And it had changed her life completely. She'd been an invalid before she was fitted with this medical invention. She was unable to work and unable to have friends or any kind of a normal life. And then after she was fitted with George's invention, she got a job for the first time, and she began to move among people, and she met a lovely young man and married him and had a delicious little boy. And when I met her on her first visit, she told me that the day she had been fitted with the invention was the day she had been reborn.
Wow.
And so, you know, you can't give one patient's name to another. That's privacy, right. It violates privacy terribly. So, but I thought I might ask her to write an anonymous letter about her experience. And I could give it to George, right? Mm-hmm. But when she heard that I knew the man who made her invention possible, she wanted to meet him. And she asked whether or not he might come to dinner at her house so she could show him the life he'd made possible for her. And I said I'd ask him. And he was really touched. He'd never met anyone who'd actually used, you know, his mm-hmm. invention. And he invited her and her husband to dinner at this very, very expensive restaurant. And I said to him, "George, I don't think so." So an evening was found, and George went to dinner at Stephanie's house. Mm-hmm. And the next week when I saw him, he sat in the chair in my office and just shaking his head in wonder. Because, you know, when he had gone there, he expected to have dinner with this young couple. But when he arrived, there were dozens and dozens of people there. You know, there were her friends and her family and her neighbors and all the people who had sustained her in the years that she'd been an invalid. And they had decorated the little house with crepe paper, and everyone had brought food. And it was a wonderful dinner and a wonderful evening. And George says, but that wasn't the important part. And apparently, they had actually come to tell him a story. They'd each had a part to play in it, and it took them over 2 hours to tell the story. Mm-hmm. It was a story of Stephanie's life. Mm-hmm. And George said he had cried most of the time. And at the end, Stephanie had come to him and knelt down next to his chair and said, George, this is really a story about you. We think you needed to know. And he said to me, you know, Rachel, I did need to know. And, you know, as he was telling me the story, I was just overwhelmed. I had tears in my eyes. But I also had a question. And I said to him, George, how many of these things do you make every year? And he said, you know, close to 10,000.
Wow.
He said, I only knew the numbers, Rachel. I had no idea what they meant. And so, you know, in the end, we may come to peace with the value of our lives, what we're leaving behind us, not because of our possessions, but because of our acts of service. And we may recognize how many hearts and how many lives we have touched and we haven't even known. We touch many more people than we know. We have much more power to make a difference in this world than we even imagine.
Thank you so much for talking today and taking the time out of your busy schedule. And I love your books, My Grandfather's Blessings, Kitchen Table Wisdom. I recommend to all of you, run out and buy these books. And they're just great.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking.
Is she a blessing or what? Rachel Naomi Remen, www.rachelremen. Make sure to pick up copies of her books, My Grandfather's Blessings and Kitchen Table Wisdom. For gifts, consider also giving one of these beautiful Zen clocks, www.now-zen.com. Thank you so much for joining me here on the web at Zentertainment Talk Radio, zentertainment.org. I'm Joe Davidson, and I'll catch you next week. Peace.